you would indulge me for a moment, I'd like to open with the very familiar Collect for Purity, except in a pretty unfamiliar way. I'll read it in Ojibwe. The Lord be with you. Let us pray. Miyama Wimashkawas in Gishimanido. Bega Krabandaman Gagana O Deeman, Kegendaman Gagana, Bago Sendamowinan, Gaye, Gaya, Zo I Gozawan, Gemodizawinan, Biniton in Denain, Demo Winanin, Yema Onji O Gichichwa, Wido Kagewin, Ao Panizit Gichichag, Cheonji. Wawinge sagi igoyan, gaye che, wawinge bishigain witoyan, panak gidijinikazuin onji Jesus Christ de benayang gid. Amen. Amen. And I assure you, it works just as well in Ojibwe. Some would even say better, but we won't enter into that debate. I'm delighted to be here and to be a part of this conference, which I've been hoping to be a part of for quite a while. I apologize, I was hoping to be more of a part of it before, but have not been feeling well since I went on. Stephen, holy moly, Dad, my bud, he's right there. We're both from Minnesota, and except he was a Republican. Anyway, so I'm glad to say that Jesus Christ has broken down the walls of separation. And I'm very happy to speak today about what I think is one of the most exciting topics in the church in Canada today, and I would say in North America, and that has to do with God's mission to Indigenous North America and some of its import to the larger church. Some of you may know the work of Orlando Costas, a Methodist preacher, part of the group that pulled together the Lausanne Conference. He died in the 1980s, but he said prophetically back then that the churches of North America were so entrenched in the Christendom model that he did not believe that they could come out of that stupor, really, until they heard the gospel once again. And he identified African Americans, immigrants, Hispanics, and North Americans, bringing the gospel back to the church. And he said any growth that happens in the church until that renewal and revival would be ecclesiastical obesity. The church would not be growing, it would just be getting fat. And I think Orlando Costas was a great inspiration to me and many others, and it's in that inspiration, I think, in that prophetic mode, that I'd like what I say to be given and hopefully to be heard as well. So, the first thing, somebody asked me a while ago what was going to happen over the next 10 years, what was the future of Indigenous ministries over the next 10 years. And I said, well, I think the first thing that will happen is that we'll get a new past. And they thought that was funny, because I think one of the things that, one of the very few things that most Canadians know, whether they're Christian or not Christian, is that the relationship between the church and Indigenous peoples has been troubled, very troubled. Over many, many years. And I think that there's common consensus, even among Christians, that that relationship is negative and bad. and that there isn't much good to say about it. I think that Christians often feel ashamed when they think about it or talk about it, and it's only been recently that I've been able to feel the crowd, you know? And I say this because for many years, my first years as the National Indigenous Bishop, they would, you know, I would go to conferences and they would say, Bishop Mark MacDonald is going to speak on the relationship of the church to Indigenous peoples, and usually it would just be me and the AV guy, you know? It's not a subject that most people want to hear a lot about, and only recently, I think, have people been understanding that there's more to be said, that we're in a time of renewal and reframing. But still, having said that, I think that it's very important to know that the history is a lot different than what you've been told. And it's a lot better story than what you've been told, but probably not in the way that you would think, expect, or hope for. That isn't to say that it does not exalt God. It's not to say that it doesn't proclaim the glory and the name of Jesus. But it does call into question certain aspects of the institutional church's outreach to Indigenous people. What it does say, I think, hopefully will demonstrate, is that God is greater than the intent and failures of the church. And so that's how we begin. To understand our future is necessary to have a different understanding of the past. Again, almost always, people have portrayed the mission to Indigenous people as failed, flawed, and at best, and oftentimes nasty, meaning that people had bad intent, bad desires, and it is true. There's much that could be said that is bad. I'm not trying to defend it. If you really look at what people said back then, the goal of the mission to Native North America was to make Native North America disappear, to have Native North Americans just melt into the general population. That's the best form of it. And today, it's these kinds of things that the church is largely embarrassed by. It's important to understand that those who said, let's make them disappear, were the good guys. You know, the bad guys were saying, let's just kill them all. And these are not my reinterpretations of what people said. These are pretty accurate descriptions of what people said directly and clearly. There's no question about it. And part of the reason that we don't know the true story about what happened is because the goal of civilizing Indigenous people really took over the goal of bringing them to Christ. And oftentimes, civilizing Indigenous people was seen as the necessary preface or precursor to bringing people to Christ. What you had was an attempt to destroy people's cosmology, people's way of thinking. It was considered to be so bad, so unredeemable, that the best thing you could do was to get rid of it. Now, I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. But in fact, there were some remarkable, extraordinary stories of spectacular success among Indigenous peoples. Remarkable. James Settee, Henry Budd, Charles Pratt, Robert MacDonald, all of them trained north of Winnipeg. All of them, some of them full-blooded Cree, McDonald was half Ojibwe. Pratt was also mixed blood. They had spectacular success. They brought thousands of people to Christ. They baptized thousands of people. Their story is absolutely remarkable. And with Bud especially, he would often create a massive field of converts. And then the church would come in and say, well, you know, you've done really good. Now we'll bring in the real church. And they would bring in an Englishman, pay him twice as much as they paid him, and he would quickly destroy everything that Bud had done. It was during this time in the mid-1800s that Bud and Satie and others said that until we are making the decisions about our mission field, we will never have real success. Because they realized very quickly that the decisions about the mission field were being made by people whose thinking was flawed, whose perceptions were wrong. And this happened over and over and over again. I think the most stunning example is Robert McDonald, and I think one that speaks prophetically to our situation today. Robert McDonald was a sickly, half Ojibwe man. It's very interesting. I've read a lot of his journals. I feel like I know the guy. I've heard about him for years and years and years. The stories about him still are told throughout Alaska and northwestern Canada. Remarkable guy. But to understand what he did and is to see him through the eyes of Peter Trimble Rowe. Peter Trimble Rowe was the first Bishop of Alaska. He was born a little north west of Toronto. He went to Trinity College. He was the first Bishop of Alaska, and God, wishing to create a divine balance in the Alaskan, made the seventh Bishop of Alaska a graduate of Wycliffe College. When he landed in 1896 in Alaska, he goes to Fort Yukon and he discovers that the Gwich'in people, there's about 4,000 or 5,000 of them, who are still living in their skin huts following the caribou across the tundra, that they are all reading morning and evening prayer daily in their skin huts, that they're baptized, that they're reading a version of scripture in their own language that Robert McDonald has translated. McDonald lands in Fort Yukon in 1862. By 1869, he has translated the prayer book, the Old and New Testament, a dictionary, a grammar, and a devotional into the Gwich'in language. He was remarkable. Now, actually, most Gwich'in will say his wife was really remarkable. And being a native person, he married a native woman. She spoke the Dago dialect, which became the basis for all of the translations. Linguists today marvel at that decision because most of the dialects descend from that particular dialect. So either he was really smart or really blessed, probably both. And with his wife, he made these translations. They're still used today. There's still a part of Gwich'in life. Even the few Gwich'in who are not Anglicans all still use those translations to learn the language and to understand the language. Now, in 1869, the Mounties come and grab him in Tanana. He's already started, he's already done morning, evening prayer, the Eucharist, and also a hymnal. In the Koyukon dialect of Athabascan, which is completely different from Gwich'in. What a remarkable person. So when Trimble Rowe arrives, he is astounded to find these primitive, savage people, arguably one of the most Anglican groups of people in the world, and have been to this day, even though the church institutionally has decayed, its presence has decayed among them so much. They still, their ethnic identity is still very much Anglican. Now, why don't people know about this? I mean, a few Anglicans do, but even that wasn't possible until the 1960s, late 1960s, 1970s, when this story began to be told. The biggest part of it was that for many in the missionary movement of the time, what they did was not a success, because success was framed in terms of the capacity of these people to mimic Western forms of culture, you see. So they wanted the converts to look like civilized people. And when they were still chasing caribou around, living in skin huts, this was not, you know, even though we might be encouraged and inspired to hear that this happened, back then that was not inspirational. And in fact, there was quite a bit of suspicion of what Mr. MacDonald was doing. In the lists of missionaries of the time, he was often an afterthought. That may have been because he was native. It may have been for other reasons. He was an interesting guy. When the bishop finally arrives and finds out that his priest has gotten married, well, he wasn't so happy, so he redid it. But the old people really liked that story. They said that, I mean, and it may be apocryphal, but they say that when MacDonald married himself, he was both the officiant and the groom, you know, and they love to describe him blessing this sort of thing. Now, see, you got to understand, this is classic indigenous humor, right? So so MacDonald, the great man that he was, he did a great thing, but he also sets the stage for some great things. Now, so when Peter Trimble Rowe arrives there, he finds these people very Anglican, very committed to the Anglican faith. Also, they have one deacon in Fort Yukon. That's their only clergy. They're almost completely dependent upon lay readers and catechists. And it's here that we find, I think, the great distinction and importance that we see in the past. The unnoticed, hidden movement of God through lay readers, catechists, and other recognized ministries in the life of the church. And we can see this pattern almost everywhere. The problem is, you know, I've probably read more indigenous church histories than any human being alive, perhaps any human being in history. But they always, and I can tell you that virtually always, they are stories of the Western clergymen who show up and usually only stay for 2 years. And so most of the histories are kind of a bing, 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 you know, then you had so-and-so, then you had so-and-so, then you had so-and-so. The story of Good Shepherd Mission in Fort Defiance, the first successful mission in Navajo history is Good Shepherd Mission in Fort Defiance. And in 1892, it's established. The Roman Catholics had been trying for hundreds of years, the Presbyterians for almost 100 years, with no success. Good Shepherd Mission is the first successful long-term ministry. And the histories that have been written about it, there have been two. One written in the usual style, which is a string of pretty spectacular blunders by white male clergy. And then the white women who were the leadership of that ministry over a long period of time. And so you have three women serving over the course of almost 80 years who run the mission, whereas you have dozens of clergy who come and go and come and go and come and go. But what's happened is that we've learned a lot by paying attention to things that we didn't pay attention to before, like lay readers and catechists and those sort of things. So in places like Alaska, certainly in northern Canada, what we see from a missiological point of view is that the gospel spread through the ministry of these catechists and lay leaders. Now, sometimes they were called deacons. There were various ways in which their ministry was recognized. But people whose ministry oftentimes was a throwaway. I mean, how do I put this? The ministries that that we have often looked at as a second best. Well, we don't have anybody who can qualify to be a priest, so we'll make righteous old John here a lay reader. You see, the reality is that in the 60s and the 70s, people very correctly said this was patronizing, this was bad, and they got rid of these ministries. There's still a few of them left, but they got rid of them and then started promoting ordained indigenous clergy. By the way, I'm in favor of that. But what they didn't realize was the power of this ministry that they were getting rid of, and that the unintended consequence of the development of this ministry, it may have been developed out of racism, but the reality of this ministry was that it had spectacular success. Now, I'm learning syllabics right now, and syllabics developed by a Methodist clergyman in Norway House. When the missionaries spread, they found that syllabics spread before them. We have many, many accounts of missionaries who land in a place and find that the heathen that they're going to know all of the hymnal. They may not be baptized, but they know the hymnal. There were certain things that these lay missionaries could do that had spectacular impact. The hymn is one, hymnal is one, and the syllabics is another. The introduction of reading, particularly through scripture, this becomes very, very popular, very, very successful. And so we see the gospel spreading much more quickly than the missionaries. We see people becoming Christian rapidly and all over the place, setting up ways of practicing the faith that are still very popular today. If you go to some small village in northern Manitoba, northern Saskatchewan, or northern Ontario, on the weekend, you are likely to hear gospel singing in their language over the radio. This is how my ministry, I'm the singing bishop. Gospel jamborees, which is based on a pattern of gathering that goes back to the early 1800s, was the principal way that the gospel spread in a kind of mass way. People shared hymns, and folks loved those hymns, loved the translation of the religious language of Christianity into their language. They loved them. In fact, in the 1990s, I led I would sing at the nursing home in Red Lake, Minnesota. And I was feeling kind of bad because I was having a tough time fielding a group at my church. And so they kept on asking me to come back to the nursing home. And I thought, gee, this is a little sick, you know. You know, they wheel in my congregation, and if I don't wheel them out, they're still there, you know. But finally, one of the people said, you're the most popular thing at the nursing home. They said, you are bigger than bingo. I mean, I tell you, that ought to go on my resume, don't you think? You know, bigger than bingo. So, but what was interesting is traditional people who had never been to Christian services had defined their identity as being oppositional to Christian faith, started coming to those gatherings. Why? Because the language of the hymns captivated them, absolutely entranced them, you see. And so the spreading of hymn singing, the ministry of the catechists, Blind Paul, Blind Moses in Alaska, they were legends. Now, what I'm trying to describe again is this person-to-person movement, spectacularly successful, I think by anybody's standards looking back now, even though the historians haven't caught on to it yet, we're working on that, but spectacularly successful. What does this have to say today? Why did it happen, and what does it have to say today? I think that's very, very important, and that's what I want to talk about in our remaining time. Well, I would say that there's many things that we could say about why the catechists and lay readers were successful. You know, they had some techniques that were important. The hymn singing was important. The hymnals were important. The ability to communicate in writing, that was a big thing. These technological advances were all helpful and useful. But I think the most critical thing is that their role was not defined by a Western institution. Now, the clergy, and I are one, when we get in our position, no matter who we are, no matter how sensitive we are, no matter how much we are of the culture, our particular role is defined by the building and the program associated with that building. So when we are there, our task really is to worry about the whole church complex. What we see with the catechists is that they could be worried about making a family Christian. And their capacity really was so flexible that they could help families who were dealing with the breakdown of their structure, which has always been the most critical, dangerous, and nasty aspect of Western culture's relationship with indigenous people. The Western culture and the church as an institution was always aimed at destroying the family. Now imagine that as a missionary tactic. It was always aimed at destroying the authority within the family, the structure within the family, the life within the family. And so the catechists and lay readers, without, I think, announcing it, although there is some evidence that the missionaries saw this as a problem, they were able to strengthen the family by applying the logic and the tender mercies of the gospel of Jesus Christ to people's lives. And this inspired families. It inspired family. Now, family, again, is quite a bit different in an indigenous context, always has been. It's been particularly difficult and different, again, because of the deterioration of the family as a result of governmental policy. I mean, people look at indigenous communities and say, oh, they're so dysfunctional. Well, that was the goal. That was the goal. That they've survived at all is incredible. But the catechists had a very different kind of role. Also, their role was not as much defined by the institution. And so a lot of the way in which indigenous people defined and designated holy people was able to attach to them, you see. My role as the National Indigenous Bishop is something I think that indigenous people value, but they value it as trying to bring their values within a larger system. When they look at indigenous clergy, the indigenous clergy get kind of pulled into a different kind of category, but the catechists and lay readers were able to function more like the traditional spiritual leaders they had had in the past, so that they were able to serve traditional functions being present at honoring ceremonies, being present at feasts, being able to offer the prayers when your son did his first kill, and those sorts of things. And they were able to quickly adapt to the way in which the culture moved and worked. I would say also that they were very successful in that they were able to communicate a powerful and living encounter with God through Jesus Christ. And this was absolutely important. This was absolutely important. Indigenous people were not, have not, are not, and will not ever be interested in an intellectual encounter with meaning about God. The reality of the encounter of God and Jesus Christ has always been the principal and primary attraction to Christian faith for indigenous people. That's really important. And when you ask indigenous people why they are Christian, they will always tell you Jesus. Jesus. The encounter of God through Jesus has been a very indigenous experience. And the catechists and lay readers were able to help mediate that. And not to put a whole lot of conditions on that encounter, just to let it be and let it go. The other thing that I would say about this encounter and why it was so successful is that the catechists who had not really absorbed the Western framework were able to present the gospel in its own biblical terms. Now, by that, remember when we started, I said that civilization was seen as the prelude to conversion by most of the missionaries, meaning that the cosmology of the Western Church, which already by that time was a long ways away from the biblical cosmology, the cosmology of the Western Church became necessary for indigenous people to become Christian in the minds of the institutional missionaries. This was not so with the catechists, so that, and this is still a big factor today, when indigenous people read the Bible, they said, wow, this is just like our stuff. And the missionaries would say, well, and the missionaries were embarrassed about demon possession and a lot of other things. They gave a scientific worldview as it existed then, you see, and they downplayed certain aspects of the biblical narrative that spoke to indigenous people. And so what you see happening very early on, very quickly, is indigenous people have a public, engage with Western people way of looking at the Bible. And then when they're together and away from the missionaries, their own way of looking at it. And to be quite frank, the indigenous people wondered what kind of Bible these folks were reading. Because it did not seem to speak in any way to what they were hearing and what they were seeing when they read scripture. And the way that the catechists and the lay readers were able to communicate in this very flexible, non-defined way was a biblical, miraculous faith that spoke powerfully to the cosmology that they lived in. And so again, you see that this is quite, I have to say, this is quite common. When I would become a parish priest in an indigenous congregation, the congregation would test you very much when you first got there to see what you believed in. And what I mean by that is they tested you to see whether you're worth any good. Now, not meaning that they would, you know, they were kind and looked up to you. They were, but what they wanted to know is that when their family was being bombarded by demons, whether you could pray to deliver them. That's what they wanted to know. And they knew that most of the missionaries would just say, oh, that's a bunch of hooey. And for them, it was a reality. And so this is the kind of test that you would get when you would come into it. And again, it's part of what made these things work. As an indigenous priest, the most common pastoral and priestly acts that I would do would be to bless homes, bless cars, bless other things like that. Oftentimes, as a part of active spiritual warfare against things, and so people wanted to know that was there. And again, the missionaries oftentimes were trying to downplay that aspect of things. The catechists, that was something that they used quite often. Now, I just want to close this section by saying, when I say catechists, sometimes they were called lay readers, sometimes they were called deacons. You know, every bishop has their own prejudices and these sorts of things and develop them that way. So, very quickly, our situation today. In this city, 85,000 indigenous people are living. Big numbers in every major city in Canada. Very little church work has been done. There was a study done in the 1980s of indigenous people. They found out that within a month of moving into an urban area, most indigenous people, a vast majority of them, like over 90%, would visit a church within a month of coming from a reserve into an urban area. The study also suggested that almost 100% of that group would never come back. Now, some people think that is because people were mean to them or prejudiced or they experienced. I think it was probably the disconnect between the worldview of the church at home and the worldview of the church in the city. I think that's the real problem. Because they went into church meetings that were run like a business meeting, like a tribal council meeting. They even had agendas. They called them bulletins, but they're agendas, you know. And so all of these things were very different. The community that I grew up in, if something's important, somebody will feed you, you know. That's true with a lot of rural communities, not just indigenous ones, but it's something that gets lost as people become more urbanized. This group of people now is being served mostly by a pretty amorphous group of some of them New Age influence, some of them traditional influence people who are providing pastoral care in times of need with the tools that they have. It's pretty hit and miss for the most part, although I don't want to say anything too bad about people who are actually doing the work of compassion. One of the things that the catechists were able to do that, and I forgot to mention this, when people asked why they liked Robert McDonald so much, they said, because when we suffered, he suffered. When we were hungry, he was hungry. When we were cold, he was cold. And that's been true of the catechists as well. The church, particularly in rural areas, does not grow by program, it grows by shared suffering. And the church, if it is going to grow among indigenous people in urban communities, it will grow because it shares the suffering of indigenous people in urban communities, not because it presents the flashiest program or the most indigenized program. I think that the simple willingness to sit with indigenous peoples in times of pain is probably the most important pastoral tool for the future and the great secret of the catechists. So indigenous people are now have the highest rate of poverty, highest rate of suicide, so on and so forth. Problems, those difficulties underline certain aspects of the church's mission as we experience it today, something that I think a conference like this tries to address. And that is that the church has largely abandoned those areas that cannot support a church with the kind of program and building that we have come to expect. What that means is that poor groups like indigenous people cannot afford a church. And so, and this becomes problematic. So here's the situation. We get calls from chiefs and councils a few times a month saying they would love to have a church in their community. What can you do to help us? Now, oftentimes, when they talk to the traditional church structure, the traditional church structure says nothing. You know, give us a full-time salary and build a building. And that's what they say. We are at a point where we believe that the gospel is the most important element in indigenous people moving forward in the future. We really believe that. And so our task is to grow rapidly in many, many different situations and to do it with absolutely no money at all. Because in order for us to build a church, in the traditional style, if I spent all of my time as National Indigenous Bishop raising money for it and working on it, I could build maybe one. And it would probably get about 30 people on Sunday. It would have virtually no impact as far as I'm concerned. So we have to find a way of being church that expands into the thousands of people in urban areas and also is able to move in those many communities where we've abandoned indigenous ministry. Because if a community couldn't support a priest or couldn't support a building or, you know, whatever, it was shut down. And as much as I might be sympathetic with the practicalities involved, the reality is that many indigenous people, when you talk to the elders today, they will say, we don't mind that you came, we mind that you left. And this, I think, is the most pervasive reality. Today, indigenous people are much, outside of the urban areas, indigenous people are much more Christianized than white people are. I mean, I'm not saying that to be nasty, mean, or crazy. It's just a reality. When you just go to any Native village in North America, and you'll find Christianity is a lot more alive and well there than it is in downtown Toronto or in the suburbs, you see. So my daughters, who lived in Sarah Palin's Alaska, when they moved from an environment which was completely right-wing, religious Republicans, Stephen. Anyway, they moved to a place where they don't know a single person who is a Christian, you know, in their school. And when I said, I just read that there's more Muslims than Protestants in Toronto, and they said, oh, lots more, lots more, lots more, lots more. So this is the situation that we're living in. So. This is our challenge, but I think our future is very, very, very bright. And so what are we trying to do? What are we trying to do? Our goal is to create networks of catechists, lay readers. We don't know what we'll call them, you know? Usually the name they got was the name for a holy person in their particular tribal group, and maybe that's what'll happen. In the future, but we feel that the goal is to start out in communities by building a group, maybe start with just two or three, of people who will come together and who will serve the people as catechists and lay readers used to do, and to create the capacity for that to grow and to spread. What we imagine happening, say down in a year or so, is that the bishop in an area, perhaps the not an indigenous bishop, but the local bishop, would meet on a regular basis with these catechists for Eucharist fellowship and maybe an afternoon, a Sunday afternoon, and then send them out to create communities of Anglicans. We know from experience that the prayer book is a spectacular way of encouraging discipleship on a family or small community level. We know that. And we've supplemented that with our experience that we call gospel-based discipleship, which is simply a commitment on our part to never, ever, ever, ever gather as a people without reading the gospel and engaging its meaning before we do any other business. And so that practice has become very, very important. I could say more about that as I come to a close, but that practice, and we believe the disciplines and gifts of the Anglican Church will serve this group of loosely affiliated but deeply committed lay workers. Now, I should say, just as a footnote, it's not that we don't care about clergy. We do. We want to have more. We want to have thousands. But in the way that our clergy have developed over time, there's only a few exceptions. Most of the clergy that have served and worked well have been people who came up through the ranks of these catechists and lay readers, because our development has always been slow, modular, progressive, and takes a long time. It's not unusual for our people to take decades to go through the process. Not unusual at all. And some of that has to do with the church's lack of support for indigenous people, but oftentimes that was the way the old people took it. And being an elder is so important, ordaining somebody who's in their 30s is not a big priority in most of our communities. It's not seen that way. But having them work as catechists or lay readers would be something that would not only be welcomed, it would be a cause for rejoicing. So We would like to establish, wherever Indigenous people are found in Canada, two or three people who have the capacity to bring the gospel to other people in a saving, effective way. That's our goal. That's our goal. To bring two or three, to put two or three people wherever Indigenous people are found in Canada. Even though I have spoken of the gifts that Anglicanism brings to this task, we are very, very ecumenical. As I used to tell people when they would ask me about Alaska, I said, at 50 below zero, denominational differences just disappear. And in light of that, even though we are very loyal and we're very committed to our Anglican Church and to its disciplines, we also operate in a way which is very open to other people and cooperation with other people. So particularly in urban areas, there's hardly any of our work that hasn't worked with other people. Now, that does not mean that this is the model, everybody follows it. We'll find other ways of doing things. With my brother Stephen here, I need to commend the work that he's doing in Thunder Bay. He invited Bishop Lydia Mamakwe there to start a ministry. I was able to go and help at their Christmas service. I preached at their Christmas service. 300 people gathered. We had, a dozen or so baptisms. It was all in Oji-Cree. The only thing that wasn't in Oji-Cree was my sermon, which was translated into Oji-Cree. It was an amazing thing. Now, it's a little, in other words, there's enough mass there to kind of reproduce what was on the reserve in a semi-institutional way. There's nothing wrong with that. We'll have all sorts of different models in different areas. What we want to do is have the capacity to innovate structure in such a way that the gospel can communicate and do its own work. If you preach the gospel, it saves people and it changes people. It changes the circumstances of their lives. And so we simply want to be committed to that. And we, in a general way, we are speaking of this system of catechists and lay readers as a way of accomplishing that. But we're not defined by that. In other words, we believe that it will change and grow. We already have some things that work spectacularly well. The gospel hymn sings that are so much a part of our life, particularly in the prairies. Where I grew up at home, it was the same thing. These also are ways in which the gospel is spreading. But the heart of it is gospel-based discipleship functioning in a way that we resuscitate the ministry of catechist lay readers, of recognized lay ministries in the life of the church. So for us, this is a great challenge, a great opportunity. We also believe that it has import for the rest of the church, meaning that not everybody in the church will want to be this way or function this way, but we believe that this will also enlighten and enliven the rest of the church to grow. I love my fellow bishops, and I know the difficulties and troubles that they face. And one of the problems we have is that we get so wrapped up in the parameters of the ministries that we have that we don't have enough time to imagine the ministries that must be. And the ministries we have are very important. I'm not saying abandon them. I'm saying that we have to create a way of being church that will expand the reach of our church into areas where we are no longer present. And we hope that will happen in prisons for us. A lot of our folks are in prisons. When the primate visits a community, he usually meets the mayor. When I visit a community, they bring me to the prison. That's because my constituency is bigger in the prison than it is in other places in the community. But we hope that the gospel will have the legs to expand into the prison system and to create Christian communities there in the same way that it did long ago. Now, I think that a lot of Christians, when they look at the world today and they see all the problems and all the difficulties in front of them, they go, oh, gee. And they think, well, you know, I'll just plug in away at my own little way of doing things. But I want you to think of what it was like to be Robert McDonald, to see 6,000 caribou hunters who had never heard about Jesus, you know. And think about the challenges of that. And his attitude was, bring it on. You know, I mean, what a great opportunity. What a fantastic opportunity this is, you know. That's what I see as the big difference. Today, we are weak, we are dispirited, and even when we try to do something different, we do it with, well, we'll try this. I think that we have to see what McDonald saw when he looked up and he saw all those hostile Gwich'in. I think we should look up and we should say, what an opportunity. What an opportunity. It's just, we have to say that our present vehicles, as good as they are for sustaining our own faith, may not be the vehicles that God will choose to extend that faith to other people. We should celebrate them, bless them, not curse them, but we certainly need other ways. Now, I have a few minutes left, and I would love to get your response or questions. And whenever you're talking about intercultural stuff, it's always a mess. So maybe I can answer problems or difficulties or restate things that might be a little bit better than what I've said so far. So, yes. Uh-huh. How do you do that?
What's the process? Is it that you recognize those within the community?
Yeah. Oh, great question, yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Okay, well, that's a great question. The greatest leadership development person I met who was not Native was a man named Walter Hannum. Now, he's not the Walter Hannum that teaches at Emmanuel St. Chad's. Walter Hannum died just this last year. He started the Episcopal Church Missionary Community. He taught at Trinity in Pennsylvania. He was a great man. After a number of years of lack of success in his work, he said that he began to believe that God loved the people of Fort Yukon more than he did, and that if he wasn't seeing God raising up leaders, it was because of his cultural prejudice. And so he said, so how would I recognize when God is raising up a leader? I'll look for people who are making a difference in their community. And oftentimes the people who are making a difference in the community were not the people who came to church on Sunday. But he chose two, David Salmon, who became the most important Gwich'in of the past half century, and Titus Peter, probably the second most important Gwich'in of the past century. At the time, Titus Peter was the person that if somebody messed with your sister, you gave Titus a little bit of money, he took care of the problem. He was making a difference. He was making a difference. And so what he did is he started contacting unexpected, unsuspecting people, not the kind of people who supported the institution of the church or in some cases were even involved, but those kinds of people. And then he began to disciple them in an intensive way, on a day-to-day way. And so he started training. Every morning he would sit down with Titus and David and a few others, and they would go over the scriptures in their language. And then in the afternoon he would send them out to teach people. And that was his very rigorous method. He demanded very much in terms of discipleship. And I think that that's one of the secrets, is that people who enter this ministry must be called to a kind of moral purity that we haven't seen in the church for a long time. And so for the people, that commitment and that calling are the most important ingredients. The training can happen along the way. And so I think that what we'll see is when these people become identified in the community, then we will find ways to train them. That's pretty much what Bishop Lydia is doing now. Their leadership meets twice a year for a couple of weeks each time to go through training. And the training is not only in academics, but also in music and prayer. And it's focused on the development of habits of holiness of life. And so that's really, I think, that's a partial answer to what you're saying, is that we will identify people based on their service, involvement in the community, and their capacity to live a life of exceptional quality. And there are a lot, you'd be surprised, there are a lot of those people around. It's just that a lot of those people are, what's happened is we've looked for clergy, right? And a lot of the people who are of exceptional moral character are not the people who have the capacity to do the academic work to become clergy. Or who, you know, when I was the Bishop of Alaska, we used to have this all the time. People would say, you know, this guy would never work at All Saints. And I'd say, well, that's why I like him, you know. He wouldn't fit into your suburban church. You'd kick him out in a week, you know. But that's why he's so good for the people he's going to serve. So oftentimes, it's very different. And the process that we've developed for recognizing clergy often exclude people who administer to these niche kind of congregations. And that's a problem. Yes?
In the face of the I Don't Know More movement.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And yet we know, not unlike the Black movement in America, the Indigenous people's movement in Canada, it's a really important one for us. Mm-hmm. And that we should look through the lens, how do we, sitting here in our developed world, with no real understanding of what happens in the undeveloped world, but a wonderful Christian world in the North.
Yeah, yeah.
How do we look through the gospel lens,
mm-hmm,
into what we're being fed from our government, into a social action that supports a movement such as this? Because I see us continuing today to disembowel Indigenous people the way we did 150 years ago, but it's a very different way that we're doing it than it was done by our Christian fathers ahead of us. So how do we love our Indigenous peoples from our place through the gospel lens that we have? And not just by what we keep hearing in the media.
Very good question, thank you. And I don't know if I can give a comprehensive answer because it's a big one, but you've identified something that's very, I think, very important. The recent polls suggest that only 40% of the Canadian public has an even preliminary understanding of the relationship of Indigenous people to the Canadian government and that unique problem. So that the first thing that we can say is that becoming informed, being informed, and staying informed is one of the most important Christian tasks today for people who wish to be supportive of Indigenous people. I think that to see it from a Christian lens, I think is important on two levels. On a kind of a straight practical level, you need to understand that a lot of folks that the urban folks have been alienated from the church. The folks out in the reserves, for the most part, are very Christian. There are many reserves, however, where the church is pulled out, where some other things have crept in or other problems have developed. But a lot of the leaders are Christian. And in Idle No More, I went to the protest. I arrived at the protest, and the first thing they do is they grabbed me and they brought me to Chief Teresa Spence, because they wanted her to know that Christian clergy were supporting her, that sort of thing. So there is a great sense of resonance, even with those who are not necessarily Christian, with the church, because even those folks who define themselves as not being Christians, they understand that their engagement with Canadian society is a theological engagement, that their relationship with the land is premised on an idea of God that is no longer present in the larger Canadian society. That gives I think that you will find that, with rare exceptions, even traditional people who don't consider themselves Christian gladly engage Christian people on a theological level, you see? So that, I think that in and itself is an important understanding, because they engage Canadian society on a theological level. So I think the most important thing, again, is to keep informed, to stay informed and be informed. But the other, I think, reality is to try to develop some empathy. For most Canadians, the oppression, the dispossession of Native peoples from the land is a historical event. It happened a long time ago, it was regrettable, and gee, if I was there, I hope I would have said something against it. For Indigenous people, the dispossession from the land is ongoing and accelerating. And that, to understand that, Walt Disney may not be as nasty as John Wayne was, but the effect is probably more critical, because a lot of these things that we see with the bells and the whistles and stuff like that, which are attractive, these technologies, these ideas and stuff like that, also have the end result of dispossessing people from their traditional way of life, and Indigenous people are passionately invested in being modern and being Indigenous, so that, and that, empathizing with that thing, empathizing with the ongoing dispossession, which is a huge problem, but also empathizing with the fact that Indigenous people have shown that you can be modern but not Western. And understanding those facts, I think, are critical to being helpful and supportive. I think that the Christian population is in a better position to be empathetic and supportive to Idle No More and other organizations than any group of people in the country, because in many ways they look at the world in a similar way. And Indigenous people tend to be conservative. They'd probably vote conservative. It's just that conservatives always have party planks trying to get rid of them, I hate to admit it, they'd all be Republicans in the U.S., but, I mean, they would. I mean, because on everything except for how the Republican Party looks at them in the reality of their life, they would agree. Sadly, but anyway, no, I'm just kidding. So I hope that helps a little bit towards your answer, but I think that one final word. What we asked this question with a lot of our elders, and we said, what can non-Indigenous people in the church do? And they said, walk with us. Walk with us. That's the most important thing. So thank you. Yes. Yeah.
But how do we, hearing what you're saying, that your work is to do to build up this Christian community within the culture of Indigenous people,
mm-hmm.
how do you bridge that gap insofar as not just fighting for your own rights
mm-hmm.
and way of life and traditions, but be the prophetic voice into the larger culture church?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I think, oftentimes, again, people do not recognize the comprehensive context within which Indigenous spirituality is developed. So, oftentimes, to use an Indigenous spirituality or symbols would be like, somebody from China coming here, watching a service and saying, the most important part of that service was when they took out those brass plates and passed them around, and then went back and said, this is Christian spirituality, and passed out brass plates. To take one thing out of context oftentimes distorts its meaning. And this is a huge problem in the broader society. So the task for non-Indigenous people is to become friendly with Indigenous people in whatever way they can. I often say, go to a powwow and just hang out. That's probably more helpful in identifying the context and becoming a part of it. Unfortunately, a lot of these ways that have become kind of sexy in other forms distort the meaning of things. I was watching an ABC program a number of years ago, and this woman was taking a group of very privileged white women on a trip through the Grand Canyon, and they stopped and there was a juniper tree, and she said, oh, take these juniper berries. The Navajos say it'll protect you from evil. Well, Navajos don't use them that way. I mean, it's the relationship you have with the environment around you that protects you from evil. It's not little trinkets or things like that, And so what's important, I think, is to understand the total context in which people are functioning. And that's what we're trying to do as much as we can. This is a difficult thing. A lot of our communities, particularly our reserve communities, don't do anything like sweats or drums or anything. That doesn't mean that they don't live in an Indigenous cosmology. The world they live in is very Indigenous, but they don't practice the symbols very much. And the symbols are really not important. So we hope that people would understand that these symbols that have, become kind of mystical status in the broader public are not necessarily all that important in Indigenous communities. They only become important, I think, sometimes when they're forbidden by people, but that doesn't happen very much these days. So I don't know if that helped them. Yeah. Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Oh, no. Okay, no, I don't hear it that way. I think you're right. I think that what we're trying to do, I think we're just trying to move ahead and deal with certain problems. We know that it has some impact on the broader church. That's why we're so happy to take part and communicate in functions like this, because we have a lot to learn from you. We feel that you have a lot to learn from us. What we're afraid of is that the non-Indigenous folks will swamp what we do and come in and say, you could do this better. This always happens to us. We're always, you know, I was at a meeting in the Arctic, and you know, these people have lived in the most demanding climate in the universe for thousands of years, and there was an English woman asking them if they had ever thought of organizing themselves into a town council. You know, she wanted to take over. You know, that's our big problem, is making sure that we stay free of that we have enough freedom. Now, I'll tell you a little secret, and that is that Indigenous people aren't so worried about non-Indigenous people being a part of their work as long as non-Indigenous people don't try to take over their work. So our folks tend to be very open, and most of the work that we do will probably involve many non-Indigenous people. And we think that that'll seed things both ways. And that's pretty much the way it's always been. I hope that helps answer that. Thank you. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
We didn't hear the question.
Okay. The question was using the gospel. A number of years ago, a group of us got together and we were talking about what the future would be, and we said, how do we move forward? And we asked, how did the elders do it? Over a long period of about a year or 2 years, we engaged the elders on what was the way forward. You know, in the past, they suffered more racism. They had more difficulties, more obstacles. How is it that they kept moving forward? It took them a while to articulate the answer, but the answer was that in the past, before they were Christian, they always would gather in a circle in which you would place the most sacred thing to you in the center of the circle. And for some it was the pipe, for some others it was the drum. And everything you did in life was in that circle, or understood in that circle. It didn't have to be a literal one, by the way, but the idea was that you know, if you had to go to war, if you were planning a dance, if you were planning some kind of fun, if you're just getting together because you wanted to be together, you would always put the what was most sacred to you in the center. What our elders challenged us, they said, now we're Christians, the gospel is the most sacred thing that we have. We should absolutely always, always meet with the gospel in the center of our circle. And they said, the way we experience church life is like this, a series of boxes. You have a box of Sunday worship, you have a box of fellowship, you have a box of the young people's group, you have a box of the cleanup group, you have a box of this. And these series of boxes are loosely connected by a Christian identity, you know. But in our understanding of the way life should be, when we're young people gathered together, we should put the gospel in the center. When we're having a work day, we should put the gospel in the center. If we're having a meeting, we should put the gospel in the center. And we had some initial difficulty and problem with this. Some of our folks who had gone to school, or who had been trained by bureaucrats, anyway, they said, you know, but we're here to talk about business. And we really had to fight back, and we had to say, no, our business is the gospel. That's the most important thing. We won them all over. How did we win them all over? We won them all over because they realized that the meetings went quicker if you put the gospel in the center. Now, why did it go quicker? It went quicker because it sorts through what's important and not important. so that when you deal with the gospel. So that's been one of our fundamental principles. So even when we gather for education, we read the gospel first. We read it three times. Once we read it, what stands out for you? Twice we read it. We ask, what is God saying to us in this passage? And we're not asking what God said in this passage a long time ago. What is God saying to us today? And the third...